From the makers of Rice-A-Roni comes Macaroni, a creamy, delicious boxed mac and cheese that's not just good, it's cheesy good. Macaroni will please even the pickiest eaters with two magnificent flavors that will melt your heart, creamy cheddar and creamy white cheddar. If you love cheese, you'll love Macaroni by the makers of Rice-A-Roni. If you don't love cheese, well, that's just unbelievable. Try Macaroni. It's cheesy good.
Macaroni, the San Francisco treat.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
It is the Anton Savage Show here on News Talk. I am joined by Gabia Gadavascacha, the political correspondent with the Irish Times, Craig Hughes, political editor of the Irish Daily Mail, and Anna-Marie McHugh, assistant managing director of the National Ploughing Association. And all of the talk, well, not all of it, but a lot of it in the news this weekend is where are we at on government formation? Gabia, you've been writing about this. At the moment, it all hinges, did we ever think we would say this sentence, on Verona Murphy?
Yeah, really quite interesting development. So obviously the regional independents put her forward as their nominee last week. And now we're seeing this pushback that I was also writing about in the Irish Independent during the week from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael backbenchers who don't necessarily want to vote for Verona Murphy to be can. Of course, it's a secret ballot. So there's a degree of drama around this. And even though the position of the can Corliss, some would argue, is should be outside of government formation talks. It's an independent position, if you will. That's not really how it works in reality.
And that's the vote, a significant gift.
It is. And it like the vote will be on Wednesday, so it'll all transpire. There's a couple of figures in Fianna Fáil who want it. Sean O'Farrell, who's a current Cian Corla, he's going for another go, although I think the expectation there is that he will resign sort of halfway through. John McGuinness also interested in it, perhaps Brendan Smith. Fine Gael are not putting forward a representative at all, which I think is quite interesting and perhaps indicative of how they're going to approach government talks. They've already sort of said, look, Fianna Fáil are 10 seats ahead of us, so let them have the first pick. But really the battle now will be for Micheál Martin to convince his backbenchers to vote for Verona Murphy. And as you say, like, it's a great gig. It's €255,000 a year. You know, you're in the position as Cian. You also have a last Cian Corla to take some of the pressure off. But of course, if Verona Murphy is elected on Wednesday, she will be the first female Cian Corla. So her name does go down in the history books. But because it's a secret ballot, you also have Sinn Féin putting forward their own candidate. You know, really, the jury's out as to who might get it. And if your listeners cast their minds back to 4 years ago, last Cian Corla, Catherine Connolly, she won that secret ballot, and it was that was a surprise. So we really don't know what
€250,000 a year plus guaranteed re-election.
Yes.
So if we go by recent patterns, and the government does its full duration, a 10-year period in the Dáil guaranteed.
And it's a fantastic gift for any independent politician, especially Verona Murphy in her constituency of Wexford. She has Mick Wallace at her heels, also Fine Gael looking to get that seat back. So if it means to her, you know, for a couple of years, she can make history, be the first female Cian Corla, then get her seat back and maybe then look for a cabinet position or even a ministerial position the next time around. You know, for her, it's a big winner.
And of course, then the other thing that the independents apparently want is a full cabinet ministry. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think, and I was saying this earlier in the week, I think one cabinet ministry is nailed on. Whether they get a super junior or not is to be decided. And then they'll probably get around three junior ministries.
Never mind, a super junior is junior minister that gets to attend cabinet. Isn't that it? That's
right, yeah. So, I mean, if you were someone like, you know, Verona, for example, maybe you would want that if you got a hold of the transport portfolio as well, and there for a responsibility for roads, given her backgrounds with the Irish Hauliers Association. But the way I see it, looking from the numbers, I mean, you've got, you know, so Michael Lowry is the convener. I see some speculation that he could be in cabinet. I actually think that would be a bit of a politically risky move to have him in cabinet, given his...
Could Fine Gael wear putting Lowry into cabinet?
See, I think it would be politically foolish because it would draw controversy straight away. So then you have got, like, you'll have Noel Grealish, who will expect a job, Kevin Boxmore and Sean Canny, Verona, and then maybe Marion Harkin. So they'll have to figure out between themselves who gets what amongst all that. And while the Cian Corla role has been thrown around as kind of a a way to, of some sort of political appeasement, I actually don't see a pathway for Verona to get the job, because so I don't see an appetite within Fine Gael to vote for her, given that she was, you know, previously deselected by that party for at the time she was deselected for her comments on asylum seekers. So she's not going to get the transfers from.
And it was they who originally brought her into politics. Wasn't exactly, it? She stood yeah. first as a Fine Gael candidate.
So I don't. And so with her background on that, I don't see her getting the transfers from the left. So you got Chrissy Ingus and somebody going for Sinn Féin. Then you have three factions emerging within Fianna Fáil. Michael Moynihan, John McGuinness, Toronto For Real. So I just struggle to see where she gets the numbers from. So then it, look.
But sorry, maybe I'm naive in this, Craig, but is that not one of those where the deal gets done and they say, okay, folks, we've done a deal here to win the independent supports. One thing we're all going to do is vote for Verona Murphy as Ciarán Corla. Is that not how it works?
But you're a secret ballot, you know. And like,
but surely you're able to say, come on.
But sure, last time out, that's Catherine Connolly. We got it in his last Ciarán Corla through the secret ballot. That was a shock to everyone in Leinster House that she pulled off a great political feat of ingenuity to get there. So I think there's plenty in Fianna Fáil now. Like, John McGuinness has always been sniping at the leadership of Micheál Martin. I'm sure he'd love to get a small bit of a blow there if he could. So look, I don't think anything is clear cut in that regards. But it'll be interesting to see how it pans out in terms of how the regional independents decide amongst themselves and where they place themselves in the hierarchy of that grouping to get the jobs. I wonder as well, of course, last time in the Fine Gael-led government, we had Sean Canny and Kevin Broxamoran in a rotating junior ministry. I wonder, will we see something like that again to try and appease all the names in there? Or
at junior level or at cabinet? Because there comes a point, I would have thought, at cabinet level, where if you're rotating Taoiseach and you're also rotating another, it becomes laughable.
Yeah, well, you also have natural rotations, I guess, because of controversy throughout the year. Look at the amount of ministerial changes at the junior ranks we had in Fine Gael, for example, coming towards the end of the last government. So look, that's a matter for the regional independents. It'll be easy to see, but you might have, like, say someone like Carol Nolan, who's been bouncing there, very experienced. She would probably well be satisfied to get some commitments for her constituency. I would have thought the same for Michael Lowry, but some speculation to the contrary in today's papers. But let's see. I would say that, you know, leading the lines in there would be, I would say, Sean Canny, Noel Grealish and Verona Murphy for the kind of top three jobs they get.
And the speculation in your paper in the Mail under the headline "One Ministry Rural Affairs" is that is what that group of independents might want. Anna Marie,
it's the best one going, isn't it?
Well, this is the question.
Absolutely.
I was going to ask you.
Does sure, this why mean wouldn't somebody
a
want to be there?
Promising prospect for those in rural Ireland. And
yeah, but not a rotating minister, please. Oh my God, not in that sector. You know, it's so long and so hard a road to kind of get in on what's going on and where
things are at. Well, it's some ideological reversal. I mean, because whatever about the truth, the perception, as I understand it, among rural Ireland and the agricultural community was that the Greens were anathema to their interests, and now they may have a cabinet minister from rural Ireland dedicated to nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Will it make a difference if it happens?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, look, any more focus that there can be on the sector, you know, and any more, you know, more time allocated to it can only be good. Absolutely.
Is social protection not supposed to be the dream job? I mean, obviously, if you have money, it's a dream job, because basically Heather Humphreys, all she did for 4 or 5 years was go around and announce the pensioners are getting X, you're getting Y, we're getting all these lump sums. So I think it's a good job if you have money, but if the money's not there, then of course you're cutting dole, and you know that's obviously...
Well, it always used to be justice, but justice has become an awful poison chalice in the last 10 years. Foreign affairs isn't bad.
Foreign affairs is good if you like travelling and jetting around and shaking hands.
Yeah, and you get to look important. But nobody ever criticises you for foreign affairs.
Giving money to your constituents, to the pensioners who vote.
Yeah, but the pensions are also irked by how much money you fail to give them every year. That point comes with two sides.
They get more with the Fianna Fáil government, aren't they? Isn't it going up to... Didn't they promise...
Well, sure, we're all getting everything. If the promises are delivered on, sure, we're all... We can all retire next week.
The other interesting element to the regional independence coming in as the third leg of this duel is climate, right? So we know that we're facing potential fines in 2030 up to 20 billion, which really dwarfs the Apple money that everyone is so quick to go out and spend. So previously, you know, the Green Party had been an easy kind of fall guy for what we had to do on climate. But in the absence of a kind of a left-wing climate driver as the third stool, I'm wondering now how the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are going to be able to sell the message of having to do tough issues on climate to meet these targets without having that left-wing fall guy. So one to watch.
The other thing that's interesting in your paper, Craig, is the breakdown of all of the various different jobs that are available, because John Brennan has done... Now, it doesn't get into the absolute total all the way down to the very last of it, but Taoiseach, these are what can be awarded: Taoiseach, Taoiseach, Cabinet Ministries, Ministries of State attending Cabinet,
Shanna the appointees, chairs of committees, Oireachtas Commission, Government Whip, Party Whip, Cathaoirleach Senate, last Cathaoirleach of the Senate, Leader of the Shannon, Deputy Leader of the Shannon, Government Whip of the Shannon. It goes on. There's some amount of jobs, isn't there?
Oh, yes. And excuse our cynicism for a moment, but it always comes down to jobs. You know, you can figure out the policy later. Core to everything that happens in politics is who gets what job.
And what they get for the job. Because the difference between being a TD and being happily ensconced on the back benches and sitting around cabinet is an additional €92,000 per year.
Yeah, but there's some kind of peculiar ones as well. So say if you were a minister of state, so junior minister, but you were from a constituency far away from the Dáil, you lose your travel expenses when you're a junior minister. So if you're actually coming from a far flung constituency, it's not really worth your while financially. But of course, but if you want to
go down on your backbench or cabinet, yeah. You don't want the middle distance. The other thing that is interesting politically is the situation that the Sock Dems find themselves in, and Owen Hayes and his likely future in the Sock Dems. We were discussing this in the programme yesterday, Gabia, and Jared Howland was of the view that probably October would be sufficient time for him to be rehabilitated and brought back within the fold. Is that over-optimistic?
Look, he said in a statement during the week that he's going to try and win back the trust of his party and also of the country that he loved so much. So I think for sure the Social Democrats were licking their wounds and really quite, I mean, things took a very dramatic turn on Friday morning when there was a bomb scare at their offices on Frederick Street, literally, I mean, less than 100 metres away from Leinster House. There was a package addressed to Owen Hayes that was delivered. Really quite scary for the staffers of the Social Democrats HQ, who are not politicians themselves, but literally just come in the morning to do their job. But I will have to point to something that I found very amusing, and it's in Hugh O'Connell's political diary in the Sunday Times. So he was emailing Owen Hayes, as were the rest of the journalists all week, and there was no response from him. But then Hugh emailed him about the Royal Scottish Pipe Band Association, and apparently Owen Hayes played bagpipes as a child and he came second in the 2005 World Championships. So he sent him an email about that, and 11 minutes later he got a response, and the response was from Owen Hayes: "I was playing a part of the pipe band Corpus Christi Pipes and Drums of Moyross, Limerick in grade 4A, quality one at the World Championships in Glasgow on 13th of August. Mystery solved," says Hugh O'Connell. So he's very keen to correct the record.
Well, if you finished second in the 2005 World Pipe Championships, you would want somebody to be aware of it.
Make sure it is known.
What's your view, Craig? The survivability of it, because the difficulty that he has is it isn't just, as I understand it, it isn't just that the party was unaware of his position. It was that he actively led them to believe it was different than it was. That's difficult to patch back together.
It is. And I mean, I was on the radio with Sinead Gibney on Friday, and she was quite clear that he lied to the media, he lied to the public via the media, and he lied to his colleagues in the Social Democrats. So, I mean, I first reported this story on Thursday, week before that, and that he had shares in the company and he previously worked for them. The following day on Friday, Kino Callaghan confirmed that he had the shares until this year. And I felt a bit like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the mountain and coming back down, because no one else seemed to realise that the major political hypocrisy there, in the sense that once he had them this year, for me, I didn't see who was going to be able to stay in the party, because you had Holly Kearns stepping up in the Dáil in November last year saying we need to divest ourselves completely from Israel.
And he was already engaged in politics through the council. Was that what it was? Was that the issue at that point?
It was so, because this is later come out, his line would be that I got rid of them before I got into electoral politics. But he'd been in the party for several years in the background, right? But and was the first elected for the party in February. But Holly Kearns had said that inaction is complicit with genocide, right? So she set a pretty high bar. So once there was any sort of shareholding after the date, I didn't see how he was going to be able to stay in the party. Then, and I was saying this to Social Democrats privately, I was saying, like, this is a big issue. And they were like, they didn't, I guess, understand the magnitude of what was to come. Then we had the marathon grilling on the plinth. And I think they were a bit kind of shocked. And as I was reporting today in the Irish Mail on Sunday, he had told them that he got rid of the shares at the start of this year, which they took to be January or February. We now know that isn't true. And then hours after we grilled him on the plinth, he came out and said that actually it was July and that the value or the quantum of it was €199,000. And I think the anger within the Social Democrats is really, 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 really strong now, to be honest. And I personally don't see a way for him to be readmitted back into that party.
And at all?
I don't see how he can, because how and let's so fast forward 6 months, they let him back in, and Harry Curran stands up in the Dáil and is talking about Gaza. You can just imagine what the response will be from the government benches, you know? So hold on, how can you stand up here and lecture us on Gaza when one of your lads is profiting on the back of the war there?
And is there not a sort of a real politic where people give slightly more rope to somebody who is in their first go around as a TD? Is there not a sense of, well, you give them a little bit more forgiveness than if they were a sealed bond?
They might, Anton, but I don't think the public will. Do you know what I mean? As an ordinary Joe Soap here around the table, I think he had his opportunity. Transparency in politics, like, we demand that. And these experts, like, that's what you demand, and rightly so. So I agree.
Start as you mean to go on. I mean, he was barely elected to the council, and he's already, you know, the declaration of his interests is already, you know, he's saying, I divested the shares in the past 12 months. And, you know, you can be sure that it was only in recent times when he actually wrote that statement. And then, you know, I think the issue was really what made it a very big story was the fact that he stood there on the plinth at Leinster House and he repeatedly, effectively lied to journalists. I mean, there is no other way of painting it.
Very difficult politically for the Soc Dems because they should be at the point of riding the wave of electoral success and being seen as possible government.
I think that's what was quite sore for them as well, that this was supposed to be their big day and all those other first-time TDs standing there and losing it. But so look, I think the question now turns to whether he'll resign his seat or not. There has been calls for that from all the parties on the left. And if you think about it, if he's to stay and he's outside of the party, I mean, you just look at it. Look, like in terms of speaking time, he'll the same that someone like Violet Ann Wynne had after she left Sinn Féin. You won't really hear much from him. He won't be a part of any technical group. So
does anybody ever resign the seat though?
Very rarely. Yeah, of course. Owen Murphy did it during the last Dáil term, resigned his seat, triggering the by election in that same constituency.
Yes, but not for reasons of being under public pressure. That was personal reasons.
But I'm like, so he could turn up every day or not turn up at all and lose his expenses. But I'm just wondering, you know, in terms of his reputation outside of Leinster House, would that actually be quite damaging for him? You know, in terms of how he's seen in the business world, if he's just going in to tick the box. I think
surely, if you're him though, you say, I have 5 years to patch this back together. I'll be the best boy in class. I'll go in and do my absolute best, whether it's in the Soc Dems or as an independent, and try to build back the reputation over that period.
Yeah, I mean, like that, I'm sure that's what's going through his mind at the moment. I struggle to see how, one, you can be effective at all with so little speaking time and no party behind you. So look, I'm sure they're the questions that are occupying his mind at the moment.
After the break, Anna-Marie McHugh, you are well placed to give us a bit of an insight into this, because the Business Post is reporting on the front page that the state is aiming to buy City West Hotel to confront migrant crisis. And were this just a hotel, you'd say, well, that's fine. You can be pro it or against it. The issue, of course, with City West is it's one of the few places in the country that gives you the scope to do major expositions, expos, because it has conference centre and hotel side by side. We'll look at whether or not that's likely to happen after this break.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
So with me, I have Craig Hughes, political editor of the Irish Daily Mail, Anna-Marie McHugh, assistant managing director of the National Ploughing Association, and Gabia Gedevascacha, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, despite my attempts to make her work for another paper the last time I mentioned it. Irish Independent, just so they were very clear. Anna-Marie McHugh, the state to buy City West Hotel to confront the migrant crisis. It doesn't seem like a significant thing at first glance, because it is just a hotel. But what makes City West unusual is, if you want to run a big giant expo and house the people at the same time, it's sort of literally the only game in town. You have to head west of the Shannon, or at least to Kerry, to find an alternative venue.
Yeah, and location, location, location. You know what I mean? You can go to the RDS, and there's a lot of events in the RDS too, which are right in the city. And, you know, isn't that just the bane of our life? Certainly for bringing people in, and time is so valuable. I get the concept. I get the idea. They're going the right route rather than renting all these rooms. We see the amount that's been spent is massive. So the concept is good. But going to the biggest event centre that we have, it's massive, because do you start all over again? Do you build another one again? How is that going to, with the government coffers, versus, you know, what it's fixing one item, but you know, opening a whole new...
Because if I rent a big problem. Event centre in Dublin, I then have to look around and say, well, what hotels will I use to put my people in? Whereas the advantage of City West was, you were able to do it as a block deal. Give me 1,000 hotel rooms, the Expo Centre, and we'll do the whole thing in one go.
And look, for business, for, you know, international events coming in, and like all that factor is huge. And if you say, look, you can go down to Killarney, fine, you have the NEC down there and the west of the Shannon. But like, just for this part of the country, absolutely needed and required. And it does need to be reviewed, because, you know, even the event itself, and fine, get the rooms, but all the infrastructure that has to be built for these things, and the number of staffing that it'll have to come from the electricians to the event contractors and all that, and fine, a lot of them kind of are on the periphery of Dublin, but just the ordinary day's traffic getting to the venue to set up, and the costs of that factored in. Massive impact.
And I can hear people in Cork roaring already that it's a pity about you, because they have, I mean, they're still waiting for a convention centre of any kind, mind with the hotel next to it. But it is the only one other than, I think it's it in the INEC. That's pretty much it that have
capacity. And please, if the government decided they're going to build another one, don't build it near the Children's Hospital or some location like that, please.
The numbers are significant. They're on the front page of the Business Post there, Anne-Marie, but the cost of the purchase and the total expenditure on refugee accommodation, what are they suggesting that it's coming to?
It's just phenomenal. Like, you're talking about, you know, the cost of City West, 100 million, the state spend on refugees accommodation this year, 1.8 billion. The state spending on refugees in 21, 186 million. Like, the figures are just, they're mind-blowing, really. And I know, look, the concept is right, and they've listed a number of hotel groups that they're looking at. I hope we're not going to be going back again looking at the whole situation, you know, the review of what the government spent on such a group of hotels. Like, these have to be logical spends too, not people see see the government coming at them and say, oh yeah, we'll increase the cost
of this. But I suppose as well, these are the kind of stories that 2 or 3 years ago we looked at as being temporary solutions, as a stopgap, whereas the reality is, I assume, it is going to be thus for several years to come.
It is, but how many of these rooms are actually being utilised also? Isn't that an issue, I know, right around the country? You have places, I know, not that far from me, and there might be 100 rooms available and there's 10 rooms filled. So that's a huge
And of course issue. The impact it has then on the provision of hotel services in towns,
that's
what
massive.
That means for tourism.
Now, that's changing
else.
A bit too. Only in the last couple of months, I've discovered a couple of hotels that I didn't approach in the last year and a half, because they were being used for the international people. But that's changing in some of those hotels. So I'm wondering, is there a bit of a shift?
But it kind of makes no sense, because we've heard from the heads of government, Taoiseach Simon Harris, Micheál Martin, even Roderick O'Gorman, have said, you know, we have to move away from using hotels to house asylum seekers. We've heard this for months. And like, City West has been used now for 2 years to house asylum seekers. And it looks like this is the government's sort of answer to really to get away from making those interim payments, to kind of put it on a more steady footing. So it's not necessarily creating any extra accommodation. It's just buying what's already there and saying, look, we're just going to regularize this. Clearly, we're going to be using City West for a long time to come. And it really doesn't tally with what we've been hearing, that they're saying we shouldn't be taking any more tourism beds out of the sector.
The other thing I now can't remember is, did we briefly own City West before through NAMA? Did City West end up, was City West a NAMA property? It's now owned by Tetrarch Capital, but I wonder, did Tetrarch buy it? Like, is this our second state journey into owning City West?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but what is surprising with this word today is that it's coming back on the table now. I mean, I think we had a version of this story more than a year ago, you know, that this was in the works to buy it. And I guess the broader picture is, you know, part of the plan is to, you know, to have some larger centres, just to buy some and to, you know, build some on state lands. But then you see what's going on in Athlone at the moment, where you're having these mobs preventing a state-owned accommodation on state land. And you're kind of wondering, look, if we can't do it on state land, then where can we do it?
Want to move across the water to look at the interesting reaction that there has been to the murder of Brian Hamilton, the CEO of United Health, the big American insurers, and of course the sort of wave of support for his for the suspect in the case, Luigi Mangione. Just before that, want to give you a shot at our competition. We have tickets to give away to Annie, because the First Lady of Musical Theatre, Rebecca Storm, she's back on stage at the National Concert Hall and Festival Productions Christmas Spectacular. Annie, it is, of course, a treat for all ages, full of the songs you know and love. It's a hard knock life, easy street, I don't need anything but you, and of course tomorrow. Hardly a moment goes by during the ad breaks that Craig isn't humming one of those. The show is running from the 27th of December to the 3rd of January. Tickets now available at nch.ie. And what we're giving away is a family prize of 4 tickets to see Annie at the National Concert Hall on Sunday, 29th December, plus a luxury B&B stay in the beautiful Ivy Gardens Hotel for the family. To be in with a chance to win, you just need to tell us, what colour is Annie's hair? Is it A, red, or B, blue? You can text the word Anton plus your name and answer to us now on 53106. That's 53106, and that'll cost you 30 cent. Now, to Luigi Mangione and the sort of the debate that is raging off the back of it, because it has raised huge questions about what Americans accept in terms of health insurance and health care. And it also created the oddest situation where a murder suspect is now the subject of positive jokes on late night TV shows.
Yes, he's become really quite the social media star. And I think it was within an hour of him being arrested that we knew his name. We knew his Twitter profile. We knew the books that he had read and what he thought of them because they were on Goodreads. I mean, people had scoured the internet for any trace of Luigi, and he was really, I mean, now you look at TikTok and his face is on these holy candles, and there's a trend now where people make up whatever, you know, they were doing as a sort of an alibi for him, saying me and my friend Luigi were out for between the hours of 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. on a particular date. He's really become a meme. But a really positive one, and people have sort of dismissed the fact that he's, you know, accused of very serious things, and have made it to be really quite a big joke. I think, interestingly, it puts into context the state of the American healthcare system, and of course the way that medical insurance works over there, the rate of claims, how difficult it is for people to access basic healthcare. And the photographs that we have of Luigi, he's very, very fit. He clearly is very active physically, and I think it was this, you know, back surgery that he had that people are suspecting radicalized him, if you will, in some ways, and where he would go out and attack somebody in broad daylight. But I mean, the power of social media and the internet and how quickly somebody can become the symbol of pop culture is really quite phenomenal. And I know that he has now an attorney, and the attorney saying, look, I haven't seen any evidence for any of the charges, and people think the attorney's great. Like, the court of public opinion can only go so far, really. So we have to yet see it play out and see what actually happens to Luigi.
But the other unusual thing about this is that he comes from significant privilege, you know. So, I mean, while you might struggle in healthcare if you're from the lower echelons of American society, here's a guy who went to school, I think it cost 40 grand a year to go to. So I don't think it's people like Luigi who are...
Well, this is the bit that I'm intrigued by is, it's not like he would have struggled with out-of-pocket expenses or excess on an insurance policy. He is not of the demographic that you would have thought typifies the victim of a poor system.
Yeah, and I guess it wouldn't be the first, person from higher ends of society to take on a cause. I know when he was found, he did have a kind of what's seen as a 2-page manifesto on him outlining his political views on this. It just seems very unusual fit. You know, you'd understand if he'd ended up homeless because he couldn't afford his back surgery or whatnot. So I'd be interested.
But even the manifesto I thought was interesting, because one of the things that I think it was his Goodreads review, he had reviewed the Unabomber's sort of 30-page document that was his manifesto. But again, the Unabomber, there's odd parallels. Ted Kaczynski was actually Professor Theodore Kaczynski, who was a tenured Harvard professor, and then I think was with Berkeley for some time, was regarded as a maths genius, ended up being in the Ivy League when he was 17 or 18. Again, all of the kind of factors that you would think, he's not going to end up living in a cabin in the woods trying to murder people. So we have a sort of a pattern emerging.
But is there any risk either, you know, if he's being idolized, could there be copycat murders? Is that something, you know, wouldn't it be beyond the Americans either, would it?
Yeah, and there was a sign that popped up, I think, was it in Atlanta? In the recent days, it was just like a road traffic sign, and it said, one CEO down, others, many more to go, or others to go, something like that. And you've no idea who's putting that up or what sort of ideas it is giving people.
But isn't it extraordinary that the underlying issue, we've just come through an American general election, and the awfulness of the US health system, I mean, even economic awfulness, the amount that they spend versus the quality that they get in return for it, wasn't front and centre in the dialogue at all.
It wasn't an election issue at all, and it really hasn't been, to be honest, in American politics. Obviously, the cost of living and the economy was front and centre, and you would think that probably you know, healthcare probably forms a subset of that. I mean, obviously, if you're struggling to pay your insurance and then whatever medical bills you have. But I mean, this is standard across the US, and it has been for a long time. And I think what we have in Europe is almost seen as quite radical, that, you know, you might have to go through a private system and you're able to pay your bills. Or if you do have insurance, a lot of those bills are covered.
But isn't it weird that it's just accepted? I mean, I find that it's like the, you know, the Kevin Spacey line from The Usual Suspects about the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. The greatest trick American healthcare has ever pulled is getting America not to care about it.
But a lot of the healthcare is not, it's just basic care. I think if you want to have a child and give birth in a hospital, it costs tens of thousands of dollars. I mean, that's just basic. That's just a part of life. I mean, how else are you supposed to have children and form a family? And then, God forbid, anything goes wrong as you get older and you run into problems. So certainly, I mean, it really beggars belief. I think in Europe, sometimes we underappreciate some of the systems that we have in place. And when you look across the pond, it's just so radically different over there.
Well, it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon, because one of the pieces of analysis is about... it's in the Business Post. It is Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos joining Musk in cozying up to Trump. I would think, Anna-Marie, this means that any thoughts we had about regulation of social media and controls of the worst excesses of US capitalism, out the window.
Totally. It just concentrated the mind this morning when I was reading this, and it's just crazy when you look at Zuckerberg and he's given $1 million to the Trump inaugural fund. Jeff Bezos came straight away and matched it, and then he talked up Trump at the New York Times Web Summit. And then you look on and say, well, basically, you know, they came along, and then you see Musk, and he really preempted the whole lot. He got in there first. And he has X now as the kind of the place for Trump to be promoted and whatever. And
this is what I think is fascinating. If you look at X the purchase of Twitter as an economic exercise in its own right, it was a disaster. If you look at what it has made him in SpaceX and in it is the single best investment any living human has made in recent memory.
It's just phenomenal. And to say now, you know, that he's going to buy. He's going to buy a place. Musk is bidding on a place 5 minutes down the road from Mar-a-Lago, from Trump's residence in Mar-a-Lago, just to be close to him. It's crazy, but it's also frightening. I might laugh about it, but it's frightening that this, you know, the moneyed people and they're making the calls, and a number of Trump's appointments already have been on the directive of Musk, and that's kind of is scary too. You know, where's it going to go?
And somebody made the point that Elon Musk in the Department of Government Expenditure or whatever he is, whatever acronym he created.
Doge.
Yeah, he's going to be in the position to sort of decide effectively or to influence what Social Security payments get paid, to what degree, what federal employees get their increments. I mean, it's horrifying.
But we're safe enough because the nomination for Edward Walsh as US ambassador to Ireland, Trump, and I quote, he is also a champion golfer, a great asset for the ambassador of Ireland.
So really? They'd be very good at golfing.
Send the pictures to the Americans, bring them over, they bring their wallets.
Well,
yes, Greg.
Well, you know, I mean, the Lynx courses of Ireland do need their ambassadors to tend to them and sell that message back to the good folks
Isn't
of America.
Isn't it amazing how genetically we just have an urge to do tourism? Come on over, lads, it's lovely.
Yeah, but I mean, look, going back to Musk, I mean, like, I'm surprised. It shows how detached, I guess, we are on this side of the pond. I mean, it's a scandal. When you look at Elon Musk's role in the US election, an absolute utter scandal. Turned his platform into a megaphone to promote Trump. No one seemed to bat an eyelid on
By
that.
By his own description. It's not like you're saying it and he's hiding it. He did it overtly.
Yeah, and then it's there for all to see, the impact it's had on his shareholdings, as Tesla and SpaceX. I mean, it just... Where does this end for US politics? It was already, compared to here where we don't really have large-scale political donations, where it's funded by the state coffers to prevent something like this, we've seen where this has led us in the US, the other end of the extreme, and I don't see where it's going to end. We have the other interesting point where, of course, in the previous presidential election, you had Trump accusing Mark Zuckerberg and his Facebook platform of negatively impacting the Trump cycle. You'll now think that, okay, if anyone who owns a social media company, be it Meta, be it Twitter, come presidential time, it'll be, okay, well, which way do they think the wind is going to turn, or which way do they want it to turn to benefit themselves? And the fact that it's been let to get to this juncture is, I think, utterly reprehensible, and I can't see it ending in any way positive.
But isn't it amazing, when you look back at 2016 and the revelations of the interference in that election through social media, and in the intervening years we thought, well, hopefully something has been done to achieve that. And what was done to achieve it was that which happened covertly and quietly simply became overt and amplified exponentially.
Yeah, and I don't hear the calls from the political class to change it either, you know. So I mean, I'm just, it's a worrying escalation that is only going to get worse, I think.
Well, returning to our mercenary desire to use the new ambassador's tendency to golf for tourism purposes, there is a piece that says that we may have our work cut out because Dublin is a kip. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but this is in, I think, the Sunday Times. It's an interview with Richard Shakespeare, the Dublin County Manager, CEO, whatever the correct title is, talking about what needs to be done to sort of improve Dublin. A fair bit, if you've been walking around recently, I would have thought.
Yes, and he's making the interesting points. He's saying, look, I've never felt unsafe and I've been in and out of the city every day for the last 8 years.
But he says,
I can understand why people feel unsafe. And really, like, you know, I wish Dublin City Council was more upfront in taking responsibility for the state of our capital city. Because ultimately, if you talk to any councillor on Dublin City Council, they will tell you, you know, really, ultimately, the power lies within the chief executive, within the lads that run it, such as Richard Shakespeare. And the role of councillors is quite limited in it. So if there's any problem that we have in Dublin City, ultimately, it is a responsibility of the council to sort it out.
Do you think we do have a problem? Do you feel unsafe walking around the city?
I don't know if I would say I feel unsafe per se, but I will say the state of Dublin. I mean, really, the pandemic hit it very, very hard and it has never fully recovered from it. You know, be it the rubbish, be it the urine, be it the questionable characters that hang around, and all those things play a part in contributing how people feel around the city. When you have tourists coming over here and they're emerging with horror stories of being attacked, I mean, that's such a blow to our tourism industry, which is already struggling. So, like, in fairness, the council need to be a bit, I think, quicker on their feet. And I really hope the tenure of the new chief executive will do something about that. But our part of it is our public transport system. And I know that they'll say that's for the government. But once again, I beat the drum for the metro. I mean, you know, all of these things come together to form a better city. And if you look at Dublin in comparison to other European cities that are forward thinking, that are trying to make the space a positive experience for the people that live in it and also tourists. I mean, even think basic things like benches. We don't really have those around. Public toilets, to try and make it a positive, enjoyable.
And some of the places that we do have benches in the centre city, like, for instance, the boardwalk down the along the Liffey, you wouldn't be racing to use them.
Sure, but I think also there is a big divide between the north and the south parts of the city. I mean, I live in North Dublin and there's some parts that you go to North Dublin and you really want to get out of there as quick as you've come in. And then you go to some parts of South Dublin and it's like, I mean, I always say when I get off the Dart at Dunleary for a day out, it feels like I'm in a different country. It doesn't even feel like Ireland almost because it's got these beautiful glittering streets and everything's nice.
But even centre city,
now, of course, the
environs of Dáil Éireann are quite nice. But when you get out round Parnell Square, when you get out round Dominic Street, when you get out round Marlborough Street, any of those areas, they don't compare favourably with the leafy Southside suburbs.
And there should be a cohesion of some sort. You'll find that some parts of Leinster House are actually falling apart and there's leaks in the ceilings and so on, but we won't complain about that this time.
We're terrifying Anna-Marie. She's already figuring out her route to get out of here.
No, but when you say like he hasn't felt uncomfortable, I have. In the last 2 months ago, I had a meeting close to Merrion Square and I had to walk back to my car in Merrion Square 12 o'clock at night. Not that comfortable. Met a couple of people, was uncertain of. Another night I had to go back to the Stephen's Green shopping centre, fine around the Dáil area, but then coming around the back of Stephen's Green, not comfortable. Another person actually parked the car there just to walk with me. And I've been in City Centre Prague and City Centre Budapest in the last 2 months. Very comfortable. No problem.
Well, this thing that amazed me, I was in New York for the first time a number of years ago, having not been there for about 20 or 30 years. And I remember the late 80s, early 90s New York.
Yeah.
But I thought there was a much safer and cleaner and more welcoming city than Dublin is. Yeah. And there's 8 million of them in New York and they managed to do it.
Apparently it's changed back in the last 12 months.
I spoke too soon.
Well, just to go back to Richard Shakespeare's comments, I mean, I think, you know, perhaps unfortunate in the events that followed afterwards. I mean, we had two off-duty guards who were attacked in Temple Bar, one in a critical condition. So, look, it's safe to say that you can't proclaim the city to be safe at the moment. I think from my own point of view, I mean, you're always, I guess, on some sort of alert. I don't think I'd feel, you know, to say you're, yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. You're always, I guess, on alert because there are, look, some dangerous characters out there. And sadly, that example of the two off-duty Gardaí, I mean, if two off-duty Gardaí can be attacked in that way, what does it say for the rest of us?
And the city is now strewn with, there's laneways all over the city that used to be open thoroughfares that you could walk around that are now all gated, all shut down.
Yeah. And that area of Temple Bar, I mean, you know, talking to a few business owners there in the last kind of six months, and they've said that it has really become a very difficult place to do business, and what they want is more Gardaí there all lot of the time, and a much bigger presence. And look, the other thing you'll say to that is, I'm sure every business owner in every area would want more Garda presence, but it just seems particularly acute in Town Bar, where you have, I guess, lots of laneways for people to disappear out of, and a lot of tourists for them to prey on.
We were speaking earlier on about government formation. After the news, we're going to be talking to James Brown, Minister of State for International Law, who is on the negotiating team for Fianna Fáil. Before he arrives in, if you're betting, and I'll put this to our two political experts, length of time before all this is finished?
Well, I think the deal is essentially done in the broad strokes now, as reported on the front of the
early January.
Day. I think you'll have the broad agreement now, and then the crux, the finer details finessed in January, and we'll have a government by mid to the end of January.
Yeah, mid-January has to be it. I don't see it dragging out to too late. I know the independents are now anxious as well to get the deal out the door, even though some of the opposition parties are still going around saying they're talking to other people. I think mid-January we'll have a new government.
Well, we'll invite you back in mid-January and see where we stand.
Very good.
Gabia Gadaviscacha, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, Craig Hughes, political editor of the Irish Daily Mail, and Anne-Marie McHugh, assistant managing director of the National Ploughing Association.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.